Au hea o ko e ko ka aha, i nā he kuleana i mua o kea aha o o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention, and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC16559, Public Access Trails Hawaii versus Haleakala Ranch Company. Arguing for the petitioner, Public Access Trails Hawaii, Tom Pierce. Arguing for the respondent, Haleakala Ranch Company, Francis Hogan. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to start today by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. May it please the court. Tom Pierce on behalf of plaintiffs, consisting of lead class plaintiff Public Access Trails Hawaii and the certified class members. We thank you for hearing our case.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Francis Hogan appearing for Haleakala Ranch Company, respondent appellee.
All right, thank you to you both. Just to confirm, Mr. Pierce, you have 25 minutes for your initial argument and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll give you a warning 25 minutes in. Mr. Hogan, you have 30 minutes, and we're going to give you a warning 5 minutes in as well. And of course, at the end of your time for both of you, you'll see a light and hear a tone to signal that your time is up. Mr. Pierce, please proceed with your argument.
Thank you. In April of 2014, after almost 4 years of litigation, and a trial that carried on for 5 weeks, the jury entered a landmark verdict in our case, confirming that Haleakala Trail has been in existence since before the Mahele of 1848 and is a public right-of-way owned by the state in fee simple. The significance of our case was not lost on the circuit court, which found in its partial award of attorney's fees that this case vindicated, quote, an ancient and unique historic site and involved a vital part of a trail that ascends to Haleakala Crater, a site of great cultural and historic value. But for the persistent, continuous, and zealous advocacy of plaintiffs, this landmark ruling would not exist. This includes for all parts of the case, including after the state's joinder against the private defendant, Haleakala Ranch. Our case is exactly the kind of case that led to the formation of the Private Attorney General Doctrine, or PAG Doctrine. The PAG Doctrine was formed around the understanding that governments cannot, or such as here, will not take every public interest matter to court, even where it has great societal interest and will benefit many, as the circuit court held in our case. The state confirmed this point in its motion to dismiss plaintiff's complaint. Quote, with due respect, plaintiffs do not run the executive branch and will not dictate which disputes the state should expend its limited resources on and how disputed issues should be addressed or settled. Those last words turned out to be a foreshadowing, as I'll get back to later. While the state ultimately joined plaintiffs against the defendant, it insisted through a joint prosecution agreement that its support would be the bare minimum, such as joinder on motions and coordinating on witnesses. The state even made sure to emphasize its limited role when it filed its joinder in support of that agreement. Quote, plaintiffs and the class will continue to take the lead role in the litigation, but benefit from state support. That's on the record on appeal in docket 96. How can the lead plaintiff be unnecessary? And this gets us to the heart of the primary legal issue before this court. Over the decades, the PAG Doctrine has developed to respond to cases like ours. Courts recognize that public interest cases can be messy. They recognize that a government's decision to join should not be a bright line on denial of PAG fees. And this court has favorably cited four cases from three jurisdictions confirming this point: Committee to Defend, State Water Resources, Bitterroot, and Defenders of Wildlife. These cases are cited in Irwin Park 2 and in Waiahole 2. Each of these cases confirms that PAG fees can be permitted even after government joinder. And to put this another way, these cases emphasize that there's a difference between stepping up as a co-plaintiff as opposed to simply showing up as a co-plaintiff. We all know that vindication of a cause is not going to happen simply because the government or another party enters an appearance or files a joinder. Someone has to be committed to stay the course no matter what and keep an eye on the prize, which is vindication of the issue of great societal importance. This is the bedrock principle behind the PAG doctrine.
Mr. Pierce, Justice Wilson has a question.
Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Pierce, you were discussing the degree to which the joint prosecution agreement constitutes a participation by the state that would mean that your participation was less than it was without the states participating. But I wanted to ask you if you could be a bit more specific about your view as to what the analysis was of the circuit court as to why that joint prosecution agreement was operative and decisive as to whether or not you would receive attorney's fees after that point, and the extent, if at all, to which it was important to the court that the state no longer was pursuing a land swap, which could more in a more clear way represent opposition to the position that this was a public access trail. So what do you think was the analysis that the court was applying when it found that despite the fact you were the lead, that after this joint prosecution agreement, you weren't entitled to attorney's fees?
Thank you, Justice Wilson. We think, answering the last part first, we think the circuit court, as well as the ICA, believed that they were categorically limited under the PAG doctrine once there was any evidence that the state was no longer directly adverse. So, but going more directly to how the circuit court ruled, and of course, we'll get into the facts as I move forward. But first, I will read directly from the circuit court's order because it's very instructive. And of course, we're focused here on the second factor of the PAG doctrine, which relates to the necessity of the plaintiffs being involved, as well as the magnitude of the burden that was incurred by the plaintiffs during the case. So here's what the circuit court said. First, the circuit court confirmed, quote, the state's reluctance to preserve the trail. And as you mentioned, Justice Wilson, and the state's, quote, joint proposal with Haleakala Ranch to exchange the trail for another site of less importance. But then the court said this, and as a result of those two events, at least those were two that he identified in his order, plaintiffs were necessary to vindicating the claims under the PAG doctrine. And then the only analysis that the circuit court provides after that is, quote, although at times the joint relationship with plaintiffs and the state was not on a solid foundation. And then he goes on to say, granting PAG fees after the state's joiner would be inappropriate under the PAG doctrine. And that is actually his only reasoning and that with respect to that.
Well, if I could interrupt you then, just to be clear, Mr. Pierce, it's your position that the court felt bound once there was a joint prosecution agreement, and that in itself constituted the basis upon which the court found that you, I assume under factor two, that there wasn't a necessity of private enforcement. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, Justice Wilson. Thank you.
Justice Nakayama has a question, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. In response to your in discussing the participation that the state contributed during the trial, which you were just talking about, and in response to your motion for attorney's fees, Haleakala Ranch said, although you say you put in the entire, and you emphasize this in your brief, the entire record, Haleakala Ranch points out there are no transcripts for the trial. And how can someone, how can a court determine the participation of the parties without a transcript for the trial? And you say, well, we said we did all this and we have the duty of candor. Is your duty of candor enough to sustain your burden of showing what you've accrued in attorney's fees without the transcripts?
Thank you, Justice Nakayama. And let me answer this in a couple of ways or a couple of points to make on this. First of all, we have a very strong order from the circuit court. We also have put up a significant amount of the record. We also have no rebuttal to any of the facts that we presented. There was no declarations or anything on our PAG fees motion that would have rebutted in any way that other than legal argument, any of that. And I would just point out, once again, we are a public interest group. The idea, this is easy for Haleakala Ranch to say that we should just go ahead and expend the resources necessary to put the entire record of a 5-week jury trial up. We did check that out, and we decided in our analysis that the expense of that did not outweigh the benefits of it, because we analyzed that we were able to proceed with that information, with the information that was before you.
Mr. Pierce, there's a issue raised, and I believe one of your positions is that the ranch was adverse because of a settlement or a possible settlement that was being negotiated with the state, and that the state was adverse because it was negotiating a trade of the trail, and also there was legislation that had been proposed, and the state's position with regard to that legislation was, you know, possibly indicative of it being adverse to your interests. Could you explain those two points and your reasoning in support of them?
So, Chief Justice Reckonwald, to make sure I understand how the adversity of the state comes into play.
Yeah, well, for example, with apparently there was legislation that was proposed, and if I understand your argument is that the way the state approached that legislation indicates that they were actively adverse to your interests because that legislation would have mooted the suit. Is that the theory? And is there anything problematic about the fact that that was taking place in a different forum up at the legislature as opposed to in the actual litigation that you were involved in?
I thank you for the question. And I understand the question. Let me state it, point out this. First of all, our position is not, while we had state adversity here, government adversity, which is one way to prove this up, we don't think that that's necessary. And we think that the Irwin Park case stands for that. In the Irwin Park 2 case, you had the city and county of Honolulu there as a co-intervener or a co-plaintiff, so to speak, and you also had other parties. And that was the issue before Irwin Park 2. But we did have that adversity, and we had it, to the extent that you want to focus on the joint prosecution agreement, the joint prosecution agreement required the state to join us. That's the minimal thing it required to do, at minimum, join us in the action before it. Of course, what the state recognized was that there was nothing limiting it from going out to collateral jurisdictions, which included BLNR and the legislature, working in concert with defendant Haleakala Ranch. So while we were forced to be the lead plaintiff, not forced, but we took on the role and continued the role after the joint prosecution agreement as the lead plaintiff pursuant to exactly the state's interpretation of the joint prosecution agreement. And up to the eve of trial, we were also having to defend against these collateral actions.
So my understanding is your position is that the substantial and work done by your organization in advancing the litigation in and of itself would justify an award of fees, and these added elements of adversity or actions by the state would sort of be, would buttress that conclusion? I'm trying to understand, you know, whether we need to dig in deeper on those other issues and understand, you know, whether they standing alone would be a grounds for awarding you fees and what your position is.
Our position is that although it's important, and the court, of course, could take two different approaches on this, we think this is a case where Irwin Part 2 should be supported and the findings that were already there, which is that the inquiry does not stop. The lower courts cannot stop their inquiry at the time that there is any assistance from a co-plaintiff, such as the government. That does not stop the inquiry. But what we see with both the circuit court's ruling as well as with the ICA's ruling is that they did stop there. And that's why there was, that's why they did not follow the principles of law. And that's why there was also abuse of discretion, is because the Irwin Park 2 case makes it clear that you don't stop the inquiry there. You must continue the inquiry.
Justice McKenna has a question. Thank you, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. In terms of your request for attorney's fees under the private attorney general doctrine, did you include fees incurred for opposing the legislation?
No, we did not, because we did not feel that was appropriate. So none of the collateral actions are included in our attorney's fees. But we did submit declarations confirming those. And once again, those were not opposed by either the ranch or the state with any opposing declarations.
Thank you.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Pierce, you were just explaining how the analysis of the court seemed to stop with the joint prosecution agreement. And I just want to ask your understanding of the record with respect to the legal effect of taking the position that you advocate our court took in the Irwin case. And in the event that the court had accepted that it had the discretion to look into the degree to which there was a necessity of private enforcement based on your participation at trial, is it your understanding that there actually is no dispute that you would have received the attorney's fees if the judge had utilized the analysis you suggest under Irwin Part 2? In other words, I'm reaching for an explanation that would suggest that it wasn't necessary for you to engage in the activity that you did, given what took place at trial, because I don't think there's any dispute that you basically did the trial. And that's why I wanted to be clear. Was there any basis that you're aware of other than this legal analysis of the court that it was the dispositive issue was the joint prosecution agreement?
Going back to the way you framed it first, Justice Wilson, there can be no dispute by Haleakala Ranch Company that we did not substantially bear all the brunt of the litigation. And I would just point out, and this goes back to Justice Nakayama's question, which I had a second part to it that I failed to mention, which is we, of course, have the record all the way up until the eve of trial. That is before you. Okay, so that's what, if you think about it, although we did have a 5-week trial, there was a tremendous effort to get prepared for that during that period.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but to what extent were you compensated for that 5-week trial?
We were not compensated for the 5-week trial. And the joint prosecution agreement happened in 2012, as I recall. We did a year and a half of extensive, I'm just giving you the rough numbers. I could give you the more detailed ones. But there was a significant period. In fact, at the time that we were the joint prosecution agreement, it was really very early on in the case. We had done all of our initial due diligence to assure that we had a good case, but we had not dug into starting any of the preparations necessary to go to trial. And after that time, I would just mention that the record shows that and again, we were showing up to do depositions, to file motions for motions to compel to do site inspections on the Haleakala Ranch. And the state was nowhere to be seen except for possibly joinders in those types of situations.
Mr. Pierce, Justice McKenna has a question.
I think you've probably answered my question, but I wanted to clarify that during the trial, it's my understanding that Path actually did the cross-examination of HRC's expert witnesses. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice McKenna. But in fact, there was almost no witnesses offered by Haleakala Ranch. So we prepared and examined all of the main witnesses on behalf of the plaintiffs in the state, and that included the one primary state witness, which was a state archivist. We did all of that. And of course, once again, we enunciated and identified all this. And I guess another point that you can look to in terms of whether or not there's a dispute is our detailed and itemized time entries on all of this work.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Pierce, I wanted to ask you a bit about the issue of attorney's fees for seeking attorney's fees. And if I understand the position of the ranch, they take the position you filed your motion, which was asking for fees in excess of $1 million. A few days later, there was a settlement agreement reached that referred to the disposition of the motion. And I think the argument, as I understand it, is that the from the ranch's point of view, they understood that there was only one motion contemplated as part of that settlement, and that your request for fees on fees should be precluded on that basis. What's your response to that, and what should we do if we feel that we need to go beyond the plain language of the agreement?
First, I have to say I cannot confirm at this moment if our motion came after the settlement agreement. I would have to go back and look at the chronology. But nonetheless, the way we see that issue is very simple, is that the ranch was on notice that we were going to seek any and all fees that we were entitled to. And we think it's academic that and splitting hairs that there should be a quibble over this is a handwritten settlement agreement after a long and contentious mediated settlement agreement. We do not find it persuasive that there's a difference between a motion and motions. So although the circuit court was concerned, we understand that the circuit court needed to perhaps felt that need to be conservative in that situation. And of course, on the issue of fees on fees, that issue is also perhaps somewhat undecided here in Hawaii. So we think that pragmatically and procedurally, it makes sense to do it through two motions. And we think certainly there's nothing here that makes that unfair to the ranch. They were on notice that we were going to be seeking anything that we could seek with respect to vindicating the social the claims that were before the court.
Well, thank you. Please proceed.
I think in the remaining time, what I would like to point out is a bit about the Irwin Park case and what has already been said there. And what I'd like to get into is that point in time, why the lower courts erred when they stopped their inquiry at the joint prosecution agreement or at the time of joinder. This court in Irwin Park II provided a toolkit, if you will, for the lower courts that confirmed the appropriate lines of inquiry based upon the circumstances. And these make sure that the circuit court would continue to conduct its efforts in a balanced way through while acting in equity. So the types of inquiries that you can find right in the Irwin Park II case where the cases cited are the following. But for the efforts of the plaintiff, would the rights have been vindicated? Did plaintiffs render necessary and significant services of value to the public, not duplicated by the state? Did plaintiffs bear the brunt of the litigation burden? Would full relief have been granted without their effort? And as previously mentioned, did the government ride the coattails of plaintiff's case? And that's coming from directly from Irwin Part 2, where Scenic Hawaii, and this language is picked up in the Irwin Part 2 opinion. Scenic Hawaii says, look, you know, the city and county was riding on the coattails of our case. We should still get our PAG fees. And of course, there's. So what I would also point out there is that the lower courts did not heed any of this guidance. They stopped the inquiry. Even though Irwin Park lays it out, we think quite well, they stopped the inquiry. What I wanted to point out is, just going back to what I think is a concern of the courts on whether or not this issue is disputed, I would take you back to this very key document, which is how the state always interpreted the joint prosecution agreement. Plaintiffs in the class will continue to take the lead role in the litigation, but benefit from state support. How can you be a lead plaintiff? And this really goes to the heart of the concern about the concern of the courts as to whether or not we put a sufficient record before you. How can you be the lead plaintiff, vindicate the cause, and be denied PAG fees?
Very well, Mr. Pierce, is that it? Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time for rebuttal?
If I have just a bit more, I would like to continue, if I may.
Oh, please. No, I didn't mean to cut you off. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just jumping around here to make sure I hit a couple of points. We just point out that the ICA's decision here undermines rather than supports the principles behind the PAG doctrine. And I would point out three quick examples. First, when we decided to enter the joint prosecution agreement, we didn't do it because it was going to reduce our burden. We did it because it would increase the chances of vindicating our public interest claims. And this furthers the principles behind the PAG doctrine. Second, as we mentioned before, we remained the lead plaintiff. How can you deny PAG fees to the lead plaintiff? And finally, here, the state was never really capable of adequately representing the certified class or vindicating the cause. And I'll just give you a couple of quick points if I have time. One is obviously the state was focused on working in concert with the ranch on collateral actions to nullify our case. The legislative amendment of the Highways Act of 1892 that the state was supporting would have were applied retroactively back to the beginning of our case and would have nullified it. Likewise, the state, through two different events, with respect to the BLNR, what they proposed to BLNR is that they would grant give complete private title of Haleakala Trail to the defendants. And then finally, when Haleakala Ranch filed a motion to dismiss late in the case, the state supported it and said, if you grant this, which we are asking that you do, they filed a substantive joinder and they asked the court, please grant the ranch's motion to dismiss. And when you do, we will dismiss our claims against the ranch with prejudice. So how can the state adequately represent our interests? In addition, if you're just thinking about public policies going forward, you got to think about influence. We're talking about Haleakala Ranch here, which has been around for as long as the documented history of Haleakala Trail almost. And additionally, that's what influence did that play into how the state was dealing with this case? That made them not as adequate as we were. And secondly, the state here was through the Department of Land and Natural Resources. They have their own internal divisions that have conflicting types of, they have conflicts between themselves. For example, the Division of Forestry and Wildlife may be focused on natural resources, which are not consistent with trails. So we think that because of those types of things, we are in a position to be the lead plaintiff. And I reserve the rest of my time.
Justice Wilson has a question, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Pierce, you have suggested that there was no basis upon which the state or the Department of Land and Natural Resources could claim it was acting in the public interest when it was engaging in these collateral negotiations. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond, because I do think that the argument of the state is that perhaps this would have been beneficial. It would have ended litigation. It would have meant that there was some sort of interest maintained with respect to the state, as opposed to what would happen if there was a loss at the trial and there was a determination that the state had no interest. So what would be your response to that?
Justice Wilson, I think at this stage, those types of arguments would be hypothetical. And that is because, and this is really important, is that the circuit court found that we met the PAG factors. And the first and third go to require you to find, the circuit court had to find that the cause that we were vindicating was of great societal importance and that it would serve a great number of people. And so we would argue that that overrides the litany of things that could always be argued by defendant Jalisco Ranch or the state to the contrary. That is exactly why this is called the private attorney general doctrine, is that the state is not always, a government is not always wanting to bring those up, either because of resources, et cetera. So, but the very fact that we actually vindicated this important public right, I think shows that we are in a position to override any of those concerns by the state or by Jalisco Ranch arguing on behalf of the state.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Pierce. We'll reserve the rest of your time and turn to Mr. Hogan at this point.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, members of the court. On behalf of Jalisco Ranch Company, we ask that you affirm the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, affirming the judgment of the Circuit Court with respect to the attorney's fees applications made by Plaintiff Path. I'd like to first discuss what the actual public interest was in this case. It was public ownership of the subject trail. And by the subject trail, I mean the parcel of real property that became the subject of the case. It's interesting that PATH claims that the ranch had didn't accomplish anything with this case. Well, one of the problems was that the first time and throughout the pleadings, PATH asserted a claim to a 20-foot wide path. 20 feet wide is what you usually call a road up the course of what used to be the Haleakala Bridle Trail. By the end of the case, the jury award, based on the video of PATH's expert extending his arms, determined that the trail would be no wider than 6 feet. That's a substantial difference in outcome that the ranch accomplished, if nothing else, in the course of this trial. But what's important here to remember is that the state of Hawaii never, never abandoned its claim that it owned that parcel. It consistently asserted that interest from the time of its motion to dismiss and its first answer up until the end of the case. I think we also need to look at PATH. The state is vested with power and responsibility to represent the public's interest with respect to the lands owned and managed by the state, not a discrete group of hikers interested in traversing a dangerous 6 foot or less wide segment of a trail running from nowhere, Mauka of Olinda, up to the edge of the Haleakala Highway. Only when the state abandons its duty should others be allowed to step in to protect the broad interests of the general public. Here, the state never abandoned its duty. Remember, the state was represented by Bill Weinhoff, who has decades of experience representing the state, defending its titles to land, defending claims against the state, seeking to quiet title against the state. He is an extraordinarily competent lawyer who, to the misfortune of the state and the loss of the state, has since retired.
Justice Wilson has a question.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Hogan, thank you. This is, I think, clarifying your position. My understanding is that because the state made it clear that it was supporting the position of PATH, that eliminated any possibility for private attorney general fees. And I understand you would subscribe to the position Mr. Pierce suggested, which is that once there's a joint operating agreement as well, a joint prosecuting agreement as well, there's no opportunity for the co-plaintiff to receive any fees, regardless of the extent to which PATH bore the burden of the litigation. It's enough that the state joined in the position that PATH took. Doesn't matter that the level of participation, and in addition to that, a joint prosecution agreement is by its very nature dispositive of the question of whether there was any necessity for private enforcement by the PATH. Is that correct?
Thank you, Your Honor. You have identified the critical issue, which is the necessity element of the PAG doctrine. And we believe, yes, that the state's, not merely the joint prosecution agreement and the specific terms that were in it and agreed to by PAG, but the course and conduct of the case after that, both of them support Judge Cardoza's decision that PAG fees were not appropriate after that agreement was entered into.
But I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Hogan. I thought it was clear that the decision of Judge Cardoza was based on your analysis that once there's a joint prosecution agreement, then as a matter of law, there is no necessity for private enforcement. And I thought that you would be objecting to the award of any attorney's fees once the state took a position that was joining with the PATH plaintiffs. Isn't that your position?
Your Honor, the ranch...
I'm assuming that we can agree that on this record, Mr. Weinhoff, as good of an attorney as he is, didn't do very much. I mean, he was there, but if you look at what took place in the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, I just didn't get the impression that the judge decided that there was significant participation by the state, other than the fact there was a joint prosecution agreement, and that, I mean, the state was willing to at least agree that they would join in the motions. But other than that, unless I missed it, it looked as though it was just PATH was doing the whole case.
Well, that's what happens when you don't have transcripts, Your Honor.
Well, correct me.
I don't have a complete record.
It looked as though, I'm happy to hear what was it that Mr. Weinhoff did that involved taking on a significant part of the case?
Well, I believe that it had a significant impact on the way Judge Cardoza viewed the case to hear Mr. Weinhoff join in supporting PATH's arguments on the various motions that were made during the course of pretrial and trial.
Is that and that's because of his extensive experience and his good reputation? That was what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that that's because it reinforced the credibility of PATH's arguments. Remember, it's necessity, but not a lead role, which is the touchstone of
the second pillar of
PAG fees.
But that sort of implies that Mr. Pierce didn't have the same level of credibility because I guess he hadn't been practicing as long or hadn't engaged in as much legal analysis. I'm not sure. Should our court use that as a criteria?
No, I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor, but it is one of the facts that is in the equation. It goes on the scale.
Mr. Hogan, I have questions from Justice Edens, Nakayama, and McKenna. Are you, do you have further answer for Justice Wilson, or shall we turn to them at this point?
I'm ready to get hammered by the next one, Your Honor.
Let's hear from Justice Edens.
I don't know if I'm going to be hammering you, Mr. Hogan, but, you know, Mr. Pierce is talking about, Judge Cardozo and the ICA premising their decision on the bright line. And as I read your moving papers, when you say that the state hasn't abandoned or actively opposed the plaintiff's case because of the JPA, I'm just wondering, is it your position that anytime the government signs a JPA, no matter how it acts afterwards or doesn't act, such as perhaps trying to swap the subject of the litigation for a Jeep Road, that means there's not an abandonment of the claim because there's just a signed JPA?
No, it's not merely the signing of the JPA. The state always asserted that it was the owner of the trail parcel, always asserted from the day one of the trial to the end, including the years before the trial started when the state was working through Na'alahele to reach an accommodation with the ranch, avoid litigation, and provide access to those who wanted to hike the trail. They did reach that accommodation. There was a memorandum of agreement. We understand the progenitors of PATH didn't agree with that, and that was one of the things that led to the formation of PATH and the filing of the lawsuit. But the state has always asserted that it owned the trail. It simply decided that in the within its own wisdom, how it was going to apply its resources, it was not going to press the issue of title when it could reach an accommodation that should satisfy those who wanted to use the trail for the time being. The ranch understood that there was no agreement with the state over title. The only thing that was decided was the ability of the public to use the trail. And that's I think, is an important distinction. In this case, what happened with the JPA is that the PATH people basically wanted to retain the ability to prosecute the claim. My position is simply that if they had said, okay, we got a joint prosecution agreement, state, step up and go to work, that the state would have been able to do that. But it was the decision, apparently, of PATH that it wanted to do that. One of the problems is, once the JPA is entered into, under its own terms, they have a common interest privilege of extending the attorney-client and work product privileges to what they decided between themselves. We really don't know what happened within that room, and we can never find out. All we know is what came out. Mr. Pierce led the case. Mr. Weinhoff was with him 100% at the same table through that entire trial, supporting him, arguing about jury instructions, arguing about motions and objections during the course of trial, presenting opening statement, presenting closing argument, leading to a result which was the state owns the trail. So we feel that that PATH was a volunteer. They voluntarily assumed the duty to prosecute the case. It was no longer necessary under the terms of the joint prosecution agreement, or it certainly didn't need to be in the course of negotiating it.
Justice Nakayama has a question. Justice Nakayama.
Mr. Hogan, I have two parts. One, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. So if after the JPA is signed and the state tries to negotiate a land swap with Haleakala to make the case moot, are you saying that still is going forth with the same point that the that PATH wanted, and that and well, they're on their side and they're prosecuting the case?
Well, that begins to gets us to talk about what the public interest is that's at stake. PATH's interest.
Would it have made the case moot?
It would have.
Okay. Now, my next question is, going to how much the state participated in the trial, I'm aligned with your opinion of Bill Wyckoff. Very talented, smart man. According to the what the plaintiffs say, which you do not dispute and which you actually quote in your own brief, the state in the trial did opening statements, jury voir dire, evidentiary objections, and closing arguments. And you agree with that. This is a 5-week trial. There's no direct examination of witnesses. There's no cross-examination of witnesses. And witnesses, no help in putting in evidence. And as the plaintiffs point out, you also, they don't point this out, but I'm saying you also have the duty of candor. You did not dispute what they stated in their declarations. And although your brief said, oh, declarations aren't evidence, they're not trying to put the declarations into evidence. They're doing it to support their memorandum. So if you did not think that their declarations were correct, in your response, as an officer of the court, shouldn't you have put in adverse declarations or evidence that the plaintiffs did not pursue and carry the brunt of the load?
Not if we didn't think, Your Honor, that the statements in the declaration were dispositive of the issue that was before the court.
Sure, and but shouldn't you have opposed it? Besides, I think in your brief, you just said, well, we opposed it, but shouldn't you have put in a declaration or some sort of evidence to dispute it?
We determined at the time that it was going down a rabbit hole that we didn't need to go down in order to address what we thought were the dispositive issues on the motion. And you've got to a certain extent, Your Honor, if you remember, back in the days of trial practice, I know I have a hard time sometimes remembering, but you have time constraints, you have resource constraints, and you have to look at where are you going? Where do you want to get to? And do you allow yourself to get diverted into endless debates about minutiae that aren't really dispositive of the issue you think is the most important that the court should address? And that's something we all have to do. And in this case, we looked at that and said, you know, how much time do we have? How much running around are they going to make us do to respond to declarations that go on for dozens of pages and dozens of paragraphs when they don't address what we think is, in fact, the issue that's before the court?
Well, I get that. I get the first part of the declarations go on and onward, but you didn't need to address that. I mean, I get that part of it, definitely.
I guess I got to keep coming back to whether there was a necessity for PATH to do everything in this case, and as opposed to its apparent volunteering to continue to run the lead role. We do appreciate that it was PATH who found the witnesses and prepared witnesses. And I know you have experience with litigation and with trials. The people who find them and prepare them are often the best people to present them at trial. That makes sense, but it is not necessary. And the touchstone of PAG's second element is necessity. And if it's not necessary, it's not going to meet that touchstone. It's not going to meet that element.
Mr. Hogan, Justice McKenna has a question followed by Justice Wilson and then me. Justice McKenna.
Thank you. So Justice Nakayama asked the questions that I was intending to ask when I initially raised my hand, but I do want to follow up with what you have just said in terms of necessity. So I want, it is your position that although the state was expressed the state took the position that it wanted to settle through a land exchange without a establishment of property rights under the Highways Act. And if PATH had not participated, the state would have gone ahead and done that. It is your position that PATH's participation was not necessary. Is that correct?
That's not the only reason, Your Honor, but yes, the attempt to work out a land exchange, don't forget, the predicate to the land exchange was Haleakala Ranch agreeing that the state owned that trail parcel through its pastures. So that would have accomplished what was accomplished through that trial going to a verdict and a judgment.
What precedent would it have been set under the Highways Act for other trails if it was just a settlement?
As much as any trial court case, it would have set a precedent among all the landowners in the state about what they faced. Precedents, there's precedents created by this body's case law, and we all can't avoid it. And then there's precedents established by litigation that takes place, even if it results in a settlement, because everyone sees what the issues were in the case, what the evidence was in the case, and they can talk to the players in the case, and they realize, they appreciate what it is they face, why that settlement took place, and they can factor that into their own decision if they're ever faced with a similar situation. So it's not a black and white either or situation. The result would have been the state owned the trail and decided that it had a better use for its ownership interest than what Judge Cardoza found if it decided that it wanted a different access to Haleakala Crater in the Kaupo area where there was none because it was all landlocked and they didn't have any way to get to their lands to manage, to fight fires, whatever, endangered species protections, keeping the cattle out, all of those things become factors that DLNR and BLNR have to take into account that PATH never did. And that's why there's a difference between the public interest and the PATH interest, which we think is one of the reasons why this case should be affirmed, because the state pursued the public interest and accomplished the public interest in this case.
Mr. Hogan, Justice Wilson has a question.
Well, I was going to ask you to help us with why Irwin doesn't apply, since in that case, clearly, it would seem that the state didn't act as opposed to the public interest as it did here, because the state initially wanted to dismiss the case, and then the state attempted to negotiate so that the case would become moot. But maybe your last point also would be relevant to how you distinguish Irwin, because I think your last point is actually PATH acted contrary to the public interest, that by prevailing at the trial, they actually received a result that wasn't in the public interest, because the negotiation, as you saw it, where the state would decide that there was no title to the road that was the subject of the litigation, would have been better, because in your view, the substitution would have been better than being able to establish title? Is that your position? Because if that's the case, maybe Irwin could be distinguished, because in Irwin, it was clear that the attorneys were acting on behalf of the public interest when they entered the case. But in your view, in this case, the attorneys weren't acting in the public interest. Is that one way you would distinguish it?
No, Your Honor. We distinguish Irwin Park in a number of ways. The most important is that in that case, it were the state agencies that tried to disappear the deed restrictions that would have required the property to revert to the owners if it was ever taken out of park use. And the private parties, the nonprofit, was at Scenic Hawaii, came in and fought that, later joined by the city and county, but never under any sort of an agreement between them as to how they were going to defend.
So I see. So the joint prosecution agreement is how you would distinguish it. But given your analysis, aren't you contesting the award of any attorney's fees? Because from your point of view, PATH acted contrary to the public interest. And why should they receive any attorney's fees under your analysis?
We did not appeal from the order awarding attorney's fees pre joint prosecution agreement. So I don't think I can sit here, I'm not standing today, and argue to you that we shouldn't have to pay him. That's something that this court could, I guess, reach if it chose and say that because PAG was never satisfied, no fees at all should have been awarded. But I'm here today talking about post joint prosecution agreement attorney's fees.
Mr. Hogan, could you address I'm sorry. Could you address the question of the second motion to award attorney's fees for litigating the fee issue? I understand the ranch's position is that there was a settlement agreement which contemplated a complete resolution except for the first motion of fees. Could you please address that?
Thank you, Your Honor. That is, in fact, you've accurately stated the ranch's position. There was a settlement agreement. It contemplated a single motion for fees. That motion was filed. The motion was addressed by the court. Plaintiffs were given time to go back and address challenges that we made to their request for fees. They did that. They came back before the Judge Cardoza, and he awarded them the fees he put in that second order. The attempt, there was never a contemplation that there would be essentially a second motion and a third hearing for additional fees for doing that work. There is no, if you're looking for an area to make precedent, I guess this is one. There is no precedent in this state for attorney's fees, for litigating attorney's fees. My experience, I've gotten different results with different judges. And what we try to do when we litigate attorney's fees is include in the first application an estimate of the fees that we believe we are incurring for that fee application and hearing if there is one, so that it's all wrapped up in a single motion and a single ruling. That, I think, is the practice of the majority of the attorneys in town. That's been my experience with most of the trial judges that I've appeared before.
Judge Cardoza seemed to think there was ambiguity in the agreement as to whether a further motion could be filed on in this circumstance. When he ruled, he seemed to indicate the agreement was ambiguous, but he nevertheless, sort of considering all the circumstances, denied the fees on fees request. Do you think it's ambiguous? Can we rule? And should you think we can reach a contrary conclusion on this record about whether the agreement was definitive, even though Judge Cardoza seemed to believe it wasn't?
I believe the agreement is not ambiguous. It is crystal clear. There's one fee application. Once that's resolved, there were other provisions in the agreement which the parties agreed to keep confidential, frankly, from this court. That's the way it went down. what you had. I believe this court should look at the settlement agreement and interpret it the way it's written. One application for fees and the decision, and that's it. There's no ambiguity in that. The only ambiguity is nobody said "and no other" afterwards. But the absence of that additional clause, which lawyers like to add to everything, doesn't make the first sentence any more ambiguous. It is crystal clear that you get one shot for attorney's fees. Path took it. They got a pretty healthy award of attorney's fees. And the second application was correctly denied.
Justice Seddons has a question. Justice Seddons.
Mr. Ogun, notwithstanding your viewpoint on the settlement agreement, do you believe the PAG doctrine allows fees on fees?
The PAG doctrine doesn't address fees at all. Well, it does in the sense, the PAG doctrine doesn't address fees on fees at all. It's silent as to that issue.
You know, given the
consistent with, go ahead.
No, I say, you know, given the fact that the PAG doctrine is there really to promote vindication of important public rights, and that's something that you have conceded, isn't it consistent with the doctrine to allow fees on fees?
Well, remember that the PAG doctrine is an exception to the American rule, which governs recovery of attorney's fees in this state, which is each party bears their own attorney's fees. This is an exception, and it's a narrow exception. And the cases that adopted the PAG doctrine in this state recognized that it was a narrow exception.
Well,
and
but
therefore, therefore they required it be necessary. That's one of the touchstones of PAG fees.
But, you know, if reasonable PAG fees, fees on fees, let's say, are precluded, doesn't that have a chilling effect on public interest litigants? And doesn't that go against the whole notion of promoting the vindication of public rights if fees on fees are foreclosed?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. Like I said, most of the lawyers that I know would attempt to address the cost of bringing the fees motion in that original fees motion and let the trial court make a decision on what's reasonable and what's not. But that issue is not teed up, I think, properly for this court to rule that fees on fees should be allowed in PAG litigation at this time.
Justice McKenna has a question, Mr. Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Two questions. The first is the settlement agreement, from what I understood, indicated that in terms of the fees motion, which had already been filed by the time of the settlement, your client agreed, the parties agreed that the motion would be heard by Judge Cardoza, and that the decision could be appealed by either party. So, and it's my understanding that there was nothing else that was going to be subject to appeal pursuant to the settlement agreement. Therefore, is it your position that if, you know, whatever, if the, to the extent that whoever prevailed on the PAG attorney's fees motion before Judge Cardoza, or in whole or in part, let's say PATH would not be able to get attorney's fees on this appeal for litigating its entitlement to private fees under the private attorney general doctrine? You know, and the other thing is, what difference would it have made? What if they hadn't filed the supplemental motion and they just immediately appealed and said, you know, we shouldn't have been limited to the initial fees, and we are now requesting additional fees for having to litigate it. I guess that would have been remanded to the trial, back to the trial court. But what if they had appealed and this court decided that they the trial court erred in not allowing the full amount or PAG fees after the joint prosecution agreement, and therefore this court remanded to the trial court to determine any additional fees that based on the initial denial at the trial court level. In other words, I know my questions are very convoluted, but it appears to me that your motion, the settlement agreement, contemplated the possibility of additional fees on appeal.
The motion contemplated the possibility of an appeal, correct. The motion did not contemplate recovery of attorney's fees for an appeal. And that's simply the agreement among the parties. Again, among the rest of us who practice in do quiet title cases, including the state of Hawaii and the other governmental agencies, nobody gets attorney's fees in a quiet title case. So the fact that PATH is getting attorney's fees of hundreds of thousands of dollars for prosecuting this quiet title case, it says for the benefit of the state, is extraordinary. And that it's being foisted, it's being paid not by the state for whose benefit the work was done, but it's being imposed on the private property owner is kind of outrageous. So I think respectfully, Justice McKenna, you know, you get some and you don't get some. They got their attorney's fees for that first motion. And if they weren't going to get it for the subsequent work, a lot of us work and don't recover attorney's fees.
I agree. I do have another question, and that is based on something that you said during your oral argument. And that is that the settlement agreement that we have, the terms of the agreement that we have been provided are actually not complete. And in fact, there are additional terms that the parties have agreed to keep confidential and not provide to this court. First of all, is that true? And second of all, was Judge Cardoza aware of the additional terms of the settlement agreement, which this court was apparently not supposed to see?
Your Honor, no one was supposed to see those other terms. It wasn't directed at this court. If I gave that impression, I apologize. There were confidential elements of the settlement agreement that the parties jointly agreed not to make part of the public record.
Is it your representation that the state has entered into a confidential settlement agreement?
That's correct. Mr. Weinhoff signed it, and so did Lisa Hardaway from the Department of Land and Natural Resources.
Is this something that is common for the state to enter into confidential settlement agreements on behalf of the state, the terms of which are not available to the public?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I do know that in this case, the particular terms that were not made part of the public record didn't have anything to do with the state of Hawaii, because the state of Hawaii was not charged with paying or with recovering any attorney's fees.
So it is your position that the terms that are being withheld from the court relate to attorney's fees and not has nothing to do with the path or title to the property or with respect to anything to do with the public interest?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so it just relates to attorney's fees and what attorney's fees payable or terms of attorney's fees between HRC and PATH?
Correct, Your Honor.
But isn't PATH supposed to be representing the public interest in this case?
They say they are, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Hogan, we're pretty much, we've gone over your time. Mr. Pierce is right up to the end of his time, but I'm going to allow both of you some extra time for some final thoughts. So, Mr. Hogan, if you want to wrap up for the court, please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. I go back to the three elements of the PAG doctrine, and it's the second element that's that's at issue in this appeal, and that was necessity. Was it necessary solely for PATH to assume all of the litigation roles it did to bring the case to a jury verdict? And we think the record is clear, and the joint prosecution agreement supports that, that it was not. And because it wasn't necessary, they are not entitled to tag fees after the date of the joint prosecution agreement. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Mr. Pierce, a little bit of time left for rebuttal, not much. So please go ahead, though, and I'll give you some extra time as I offer to Mr. Hogan as well.
Thank you, Chief Justice. My friend and opponent, Frank Hogan, has started by talking about the width of the trail, and that was what was really troubling Haleakala Ranch. But this, and of course, we both may be suffering memory losses because this was quite some time ago when we were doing this case. It was filed in 2011. But there's a couple of interesting things that come out of that, starting with that. The first one is if this the 30B6 deposition transcript is before this court in the record, and if you go there, the width of the trail was never the issue. The focus there by Haleakala Ranch was that they stated that they had never that the trail had been relinquished by the government at some point in time, either by the Kingdom of Hawaii or the Territory of Hawaii, those two governments. But in fact, they showed no evidence of it, and that's why ultimately, before the jury trial, the circuit court entered a motion in limine prohibiting the ranch from bringing in any types of arguments to that degree that there had been relinquishment. But the other thing
is, Justice McKenna has a question, and I don't want to interrupt you. I want to be sure, though, that she has a chance to ask her question. Justice McKenna.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Pierce, I'm following up on my last line of questions with Mr. Hogan. So you have a separate agreement with HRC regarding attorney's fees, which the state has signed, which have been withheld from this court. Is that right?
That's not accurate, Justice McKenna. Thank you for asking me the question as well. And I did want to get there. And I do not have it directly in front of me, but let me say this, and this I think will appease your concerns. This court needs to remember that we were representing the class. And so everything we did had to be approved by the class, and we had to provide notice to the class. So what you will actually find is that once the joint settlement agreement was proposed, it was presented to the court, and thereafter we asked the court for permission. The court conditioned its approval on there being no objections from the class, and then that was circulated through newspapers and other sources to assure that the public had notice. And what you'll find, I believe, Justice McKenna, there, is that the entire agreement, the entire settlement agreement is there, but for any redacted parts. And the redacted parts are extremely minimal, such that there would not be any state concerns or public interest concerns. And I hope that helps.
How is this court supposed to know that? How are the courts supposed to know that a class action settlement has confidential terms that are being withheld from the class in the court? And we're to trust you, the counsel, that this is in the class's interest, and we're to trust counsel that PATH, which is supposed to be representing the interests of the public, has fulfilled its duties and should be entitled to private attorney general doctrine attorney's fees as a representative of the public. I'm very confused as to why the parties here think that the terms of the settlement agreement do not need to be provided to the court in its entirety, to the trial court for approval of the settlement, as well as to this court in seeking private attorney general fees.
I think if you look at what is redacted, there can be no public interest concerns. But secondly, as
how are we supposed to know if we can't look?
Oh, the settlement agreement is in the record, and it was presented to the class. This is what
we
gave.
But you said the portions were redacted, except for portions that were redacted.
You can see what's redacted. It's very, very short. It's extremely minimal.
So that's a part of the record?
That is part of the record. In fact, you will find it. And when we filed notice of and placed our position on it. But the other answer I would give you to why this court should not be concerned, and this goes to Mr. Hogan, who has argued that the state was very much there. The state was very much there during the settlement process and signed off. And so we certainly know that they were protecting their the public's interest during that sign off of the settlement agreement. But you will see a very robust record of the settlement agreement after it was proposed.
Just so I can follow up on Justice McKenna's question, there is an unredacted version of the settlement agreement in the record. I'm looking at a redacted version now.
No, and I apologize if I confused on that one, Chief Justice. There is not an unredacted version.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
So where is the unredacted version?
That would be with the parties and with the mediator of our settlement agreement, who was brought in by the circuit court to assist in the mediation.
Very well. Mr. Pierce, would you like to continue with, again, wrapping up any further rebuttal?
Thank you, if I may. And this is, I think, a worthy point, is that Mr. Hogan stated that we claimed from the beginning that the trail is 20 feet wide. I would just point out that in the complaint, we didn't claim that. That comes from a Maui News article from 1905, which was actually one of the first documents that put us on the trail of what was going on. And in that, this is from allegation 93 in our original complaint. It says, Contractor Dugan of Honolulu had the contract to open the trail, cleared out the loose stones, and cut and cleared away the bush to a width of 20 feet. The fingerboards are set 1/5 of a mile apart and give the distance on each. So that's where that comes from. But when it came to our expert, it was our expert's opinion, not Haleakala Ranch's, that the trail width should be properly 6 feet wide based upon other trails in Hawaii. So going on beyond that.
Justice McKenna has a question, Mr. Pierce. Justice McKenna.
I just have one final question regarding the settlement agreement. Is there anything that in the redacted sections that implicate any person's privacy rights?
There would not be, Justice McKenna. And I think what I heard Mr. Hogan say, and I will agree, is that any redacted parts related to the monetary compensation.
And the parties believe that the court, neither the court nor the class needed to see that.
I certainly, standing before the bar today, can say in very good conscience that we did not do anything that did not further judicial economy and protect the public's interests. And that certainly is carried out by, we really considered our obligations to the class to be very important obligations. And that's why you'll see that in our submission when we put everybody on notice about this proposed settlement. And by the way, there was, we also had a phase one and a phase two. So this permitted us to not have to continue the litigation beyond that time. And there would have been a whole another significant phase two of the trial of the circuit court action that would have revolved around whether or not public access should be opened.
And that's a part of the redaction.
No. I'm just explaining that that's there's nothing. And what you see is that's redacted. There is the minimal parts.
Mr. Pierce, any final thoughts to wrap up for the court today?
We would just point out, going back to something that Justice Edmonds says, and I'm just going to say this generically, not just with respect to fees on fees or the PAG doctrine. If you go back to Irwin Park, Irwin Park quotes from Waiahole 2, which is quoting from Serrano. And in Serrano, and the court identified this, it was setting forth the policy that underlie the public, the private attorney general doctrine. The goal of the doctrine is to award attorney's fees to deserving interests to the end that support may be provided for future representation of interests of similar character in future litigation. And we think this is critical. All the public interest groups, in Hawaii are going to be looking at how the court decides this case. And we would ask that this court confirm the breadth of the Irwin Park 2 decision and overturn the ICA. We would also ask, in addition, if I may very quickly, in terms of the relief, all of the evidence is in the record. It cannot be disputed, and that plaintiffs bore the burden. If you look at our itemized fees, they show all of the reasonable time entries. The circuit court already established the hourly rate. So we would ask for this court to award fees. And I would point out at the beginning of this that it's our position that the trial court and the ICA disregarded the principles of law behind the PAG doctrine. And thus, this court may review de novo the award of PAG fees. So we think this court is able to require on remand that fees would be awarded from the time that they were denied until the final judgment was entered, plus the motions practice relating to fees on fees under the U.S. Supreme Court that we cite, INS, where the, and by the way, I would just point out that Mr. Hogan talks about the practice in Hawaii. This court normally on procedural issues will look to the federal courts, and the federal court show that that normally you have a two motion process when it comes to fees on fees. So we would thank the court for hearing our case, and we look forward to the court's ruling.
All right. Thank you very much to both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolokolo ki'e ki'e hano hano o ka moku'aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.